Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The newest prostate screening, cancer screening recommendations have, I think, led to some confusion and uncertainty in patients. And then I get articles that look like this. I have to be honest, I was reading my AARP bulletin for March 2004, and the headline says, "Doctors say skip these tests." And the small print was, "Doctors warn that some of the most common medical tests and routinely taken by Americans do more harm, waste billions of dollars, and could endanger your health and even your life." Yeah, I'm aware of that. Number three was PSA screening for prostate cancer. And although I think at my age I'm pretty aware of what's going on about prostate cancer, it made me think that perhaps there's a lot of misconceptions and that headlines like this might also do harm themselves, which may not be measured. So I wanted to present a show where we were trying to clarify these recommendations as they currently stand, and more importantly, help people understand the reasoning and evidence behind the guidelines. So I've asked a new member of the Anchorage medical community, Dr. Josh Logan, to come on the air today. Josh is a urological oncologist. In fact, he is the first and maybe still the only urological oncologist in Alaska. So Josh, welcome to Line One.
Thanks, Dr. Woodard.
So for those of you who have never done this before, if you want to give us a call during the program, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Logan did his urologic oncology training at UCLA in Los Angeles, and then joined us less than a year ago.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with the basics. What's a PSA?
Yeah, so PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and that is a protein which is primarily made by epithelial cells in the prostate, and it's excreted in the blood, and it's tested by a simple blood draw and results a value that can be quantified.
What kind of factors might contribute to a PSA test being abnormal, lower or higher than what we'd expect it to be?
Yeah. So part of the quandary is that it's prostate-specific antigen, not prostate cancer-specific antigen. And so any one of a number of things can cause an elevation. And so I usually get stuck with, trying to sort out, is this elevated due to cancer or is this elevated due to, say, inflammation, infection, previous ejaculation can cause transient rises, instrumentation of the genitourinary tract can cause rises. And so it's certainly not a perfect test, but it is what we have today.
And I should quickly point out, if people have been listening to this, they're not any perfect tests. This is not a great maybe test. We'll talk about that a little bit, but there's no perfect test. We're never going to have anything that's 100% safe and effective but never misses, is a general rule. Yep. So how's this related to cancer then?
Yeah, so basically it does pretty reliably rise in the face of cancer. That's kind of how it stepped on the scene and the role it has today for screening for prostate cancer.
And is it the absolute amount, the rate of increase, and how does age come into a factor? Because I think age also is a contributing
Absolutely.
Factor to the level.
Kind of all of the above. 10 years ago, when I was a second-year medical student, we were taught unequivocally everything above 4 was abnormal and everything below 4 was normal. And, time has gone on, and that approach has certainly been refined. Data out of the prostate cancer prevention trial, which was published in 2003-2004, showed that there was no level of PSA at which a person could not have prostate cancer. So what became of that was basically a refinement of kind of definitions of normal, such that currently, there's an age-adjusted approach for men between 40 and 49. The mean value is about 0.7 with a high end of normal of 2.5. for guys that are 50 to 59, mean value of about 0.9 with a high end of normal 3.5 in the 60s. 1.2 is the average value, and 4.5 is the high end of normal. And then in the 70s, it jumps up to the high end of normal is about 6.5. Mm-hmm. But and then to one other point you made, yes, absolutely, changes over time are also important. Mm-hmm. And it's probably one of the more informative factors is what's going on over time.
Mm-hmm. So besides a PSA, there is often, at least from my experience for getting my annual prostate screening, is a digital exam. Is that still typically recommended, and how useful to the detection of prostate cancers is the exam?
Yeah, I think it's still part of the screening. I think complete screening is a PSA and a digital rectal exam. I find that the majority of prostate cancer is detected with an elevated PSA or some change in PSA over time rather than by a digital rectal exam. But the digital rectal exam can certainly raise suspicion if there's an abnormality felt.
Let me remind listeners once again, my guest today is Dr. Josh Logan. He's a urological oncologist practicing here with the Anchorage Cancer Treatment Center, the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center. And if you've got questions or comments about anything you hear today, this is the time to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email questions during the next 50 minutes or so at line1, and you have to spell that out, all one word, line1, at alaskapublic.org. Another issue that makes it confusing, other than just what the numbers mean and what the exam means, is the idea that people may have heard that you may not die of prostate cancer if you're diagnosed with prostate cancer. So let's talk about prostate cancer. As my old training people used to say, is like a person. How do we recognize this guy, and what might be different about him?
So as the disease itself, how might you recognize him?
Yeah.
Elevated PSA, abnormal digital rectal exam, those things would merit a biopsy of the prostate.
Okay.
And that will result a pathologic diagnosis one way or the other, either as benign or malignant. Mm-hmm. And once you have a diagnosis of malignancy, is further characterized by how aggressive or unaggressive the tumor is based on the Gleason score. And so it begins to form a picture. So once you've got a diagnosis of a Gleason score plus a PSA, you're starting to put a picture together for kind of the aggressiveness of the overall cancer, which should inform how a patient moves forward.
So Gleason score is what happens when a pathologist looks at some of the tissue that you've obtained for him through a biopsy, mm-hmm. and makes a educated guess. And I'm choosing my words carefully, and I don't want you to be afraid to say, nah, that's wrong. But I'm saying an educated guess about the aggressiveness of this tumor.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think it first was introduced by Dr. Gleason, a pathologist, in 1966. And, here we are almost 50 years later, kind of still using that system. So in a way, that's a hats off to him for coming up with such a durable system. And the other remarkable thing about it is the consistency. There's a very high correlation in terms of inter-observer variability. Mm-hmm. So it's a very good test. But at the same time, you're kind of thinking to yourself, it's 2014. We live in the molecular era. There's got to be something more. Mm-hmm. So,
part of this decision or idea that we're talking about in a minute, I hope that we get to, is this AARP recommendation saying that, and national recommendations, that maybe we should be backing off the PSA. And part of the rationale there is that so many men, after a certain age anyway, even if they have prostate cancer, may not even need a biopsy, because most prostate cancers, although we hate to think we're living with a cancer, is generally a slow-growing guy. This is not something that's going to do us a heck of a lot of pain or discomfort, mm-hmm. or kill us. Is that valid? And you can't tell without a biopsy and a Gleason, you can't get any real good feeling otherwise about how aggressive this tumor is going
to
be?
Yeah, I think a great point, at least to bring some context, is that the majority of men with prostate cancer die of heart disease. You know, and so also if you look at the amount of men who are diagnosed annually, it's a fraction of that die of prostate cancer. So currently the number of people who are diagnosed annually is decreasing. It peaked in 2012 at about 244,000, and the deaths related to prostate cancer in the 30,000 range. And now I think the diagnosis down, the last report I saw was about 230,000-something. So it's the majority of men are going to die of some other cause.
And is it true then that the primary reason for that is it's primarily a disease of older individuals who are going to die of something else before that cancer gets them?
Yeah, exactly. And autopsy studies have shown, you know, 80% of 80-year-olds have prostate cancer, which is typically going to be an indolent form. Mm-hmm. But there's also data to suggest that the older you get, the more aggressive that cancer is going to be. And that's what's led some people to be a little hesitant about the recommendation to abandon screening in men over 70. So I think any approach you take has got to be patient-centered. And by that, I mean it's got to be tailored to taking into consideration everything about the patient. If the patient is otherwise healthy and you can look at the patient and barring a catastrophic accident, the patient can expect to live for an additional 10, 15 years, I mean, it may be a worthwhile, consideration.
And I think what you're implying, something I want to make sure we get back to also, is recommendations or general recommendations and then specific recommendations for individuals have to take into account a lot more factors, seems to me.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Mike, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Just wondering, could you explain a PCA3 test?
Yes. So thanks for calling. And the PCA3 is most useful in men who have had an elevated PSA or a quickly rising PSA, have subsequently had a biopsy, and that biopsy came back negative. A PCA3 is then a good test to stratify or risk stratify whether or not you should be strongly considering having another prostate biopsy. And so
it's not like a test you can do that, like say to back up the PCA test or.
There are some people that use it in that context, but kind of its primary application is to sort out those people that are in that dilemma of a rising PSA in the face of a negative biopsy.
And you want to stay tuned. We're going to talk about some options in that situation, particularly if this applies to you, that you're having a rising PSA and a negative biopsy.
Say that again?
If you're having a rising PSA...
Okay.
And a negative biopsy. So it looks like so the PSA3 was something to maybe make people more suspicious that we're missing something in the prostate. And what I'm saying is if that specifically is your case, you want to hang on because we're going to talk about that issue a little bit more in depth here.
All right. I'll hang on.
All right, Mike. Thanks very much for your call. Here's an email, Josh. It says, is it always prostate cancer if your PSA rises and you've had your prostate removed because of a previous cancer? So I'm interpreting this email as I don't have a prostate anymore and it sounds like my PSA is rising. What does that mean?
Yeah, so you have to rule out what we call biochemical recurrence. You know, in that situation, it's informative to know the characteristics of the prostate cancer when it came out. The pathology report would be informative, but nonetheless, a rising PSA in a man who's had a prostatectomy certainly merits further investigation, because you need to know if that rising PSA represents persistent prostate cancer. But there are scenarios where there are men that have a small piece of normal prostate tissue that got left behind at the time of prostatectomy, and they may just have a kind of a basal level of PSA throughout the rest of their life, and it doesn't represent, you know, prostate cancer. But that can really only kind of be sorted out with time and likely more tests.
Okie doke. I have another caller. Andrew, you're on line one?
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I'm a physician here in Anchorage, a family medicine physician with a pretty strong interest in evidence-based medicine. And I was wondering if the guest could comment about the randomized controlled trial and the mortality benefit in as far as number needed to treat, and overdiagnosis and number needed to harm.
Yeah, right. Excellent questions. And anytime you're talking about PSA these days, you have to talk about these studies. So, in addition to what you're talking about is the recommendations that came from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, where they gave it a grade D and suggested abandoning PSA screening. And that was based on two trials, one out of the U.S. and one out of Europe. The problem with the U.S. trial that is kind of somewhat, I guess, makes it a non-starter in my mind is that when they randomized their patients, as much as 50% in the non-screened arm were screened. So it just really muddies the water in trying to determine what, if anything, that showed, because, you know, they were trying to demonstrate whether or not you could reduce prostate cancer mortality by screening. So I don't know that study was very helpful. That was about 70,000 men. The European trial, on the other hand, randomized about a little over 160,000 men, and they actually showed a benefit to screening. I think the problem that people had was that at 9 years is where they reported their data initially, you had to screen about 1,400 men, and you had to treat screen 1,400 men to save a man's life, and then number needed to treat was 45. It's interesting, though, that they republished their data at 11 years, and that number dropped to about screen about 1,000 men and treat 35 to save a man's life. And so, which coincides with the fact that we know that prostate cancer is, at the 10,000-foot view, it's a slow-growing cancer with a fairly typically long natural history, and so it's going to be interesting to see when they update their findings again to see if that decline in number needed to treat, is that just linear over time, or is it going to drop exponentially? I don't know. So I think you had one other question.
Did that answer your question?
That answered the first part about mortality.
Okay.
The second part was about overdiagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So I want to get to, I think what you're getting at is that overdiagnosis leads to complications and problems in people who do not have cancer in the first place. Is that where you're going?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and address that. And incidentally, if people go to alaskapublic.org, our website, we have an infographic, which I think is the best thing I've seen, if you want to look at a picture that shows these numbers we're talking about and can give you some idea, maybe better conceptually, about the risks and benefits that have to be weighed when we start pursuing this diagnosis. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that primarily the risk associated, or the risk inherent to all of this, is that there doesn't seem to be a disconnect between screening, diagnosis, and treatment. And so, which kind of got us into the current situation that we're in right now. But because as a result of the recommendations that came out, it really kind of led those who are managing prostate cancer to take a step back and say, gosh, how can we do a better job? How can we refine our approach? The encouraging thing, if you look at data published by the American Cancer Society, over the last 20 years, there's been a 40% reduction in the mortality related to prostate cancer. And if you look at that curve, when that curve takes a turn and starts to go down, it was at the introduction of PSA screening in the early 90s. disease. So in terms of morbidity associated with all of this, at the screening level, there's certainly anxiety morbidity associated with it. But if you talk about the physical morbidity associated with treatment, it's not negligible. And I think urges us to take a more refined approach.
Yet, I would say in the ERSCP study that you quoted, mm-hmm. there was 70% more cancer in the screen group than in the unscreened group.
So, in terms of, I guess I'm trying to understand your question.
How many people that get screened for prostate cancer, how many more will be diagnosed with prostate cancer than would ever be a cancer patient had they not been screened?
I think that would depend on your level of PSA cutoff for making a decision to do a biopsy.
Okay.
Yeah, so currently there are three different large organizations making recommendations for PSA in this country and others in other countries. And I've also added a link to the English, the Great Britain's recommendations, which is really worth listening to because of this issue of accuracy of diagnosis. And what it led me to do when I'm thinking about this, Andrew, is, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, these general guidelines are great generally, and that's what I was getting at with my headlines from AARP, but there are individuals who may be of different race, may have a different family history background, may have a longer expected lifespan, may have other confounding variables, so that their recommendations might be to be more aggressive about management than the general guidelines, given all the information we know right now, and that these guidelines are also moving targets, not only for individuals, but for where we are with time. And we're going to talk a little bit here in a minute about PSAs that are rising with a negative biopsy again, because I think in the past we've thought those things were false positive PSAs, when in fact they may not be false positive PSAs, and the reasons why we think that now. I guess it is still, this is getting pretty sophisticated. This is what physicians do. We're constantly looking at the best evidence we can, and we don't want to do any harm, and we want to do the best we can for people, and we certainly don't want to miss an aggressive cancer. Those are the issues, as I understand. Is that right, Andrew?
Yes. And in my closing comment, I would toss out that amongst the things you mentioned, the Cochrane Review website at cochrane.org has an excellent review on this topic.
All right. Andrew, are you screening in your practice?
Currently, I'm not practicing primary care right now.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that I am hesitant to get back into what I trained in primary care, is my recommendation right now to patients would probably be different than what I recommend to friends and family, because there's medical legal liability issues around not recommending to screen for patients. And
interesting.
I lose sleep over that.
Right. I understand.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Andrew, keep listening if you can. We got some other important information you're not aware of here. At least I wasn't. All right. So we're going to take our standard break here, and then we'll continue. I've got somebody waiting online, and we'll continue to talk with Dr. Josh Logan about diagnosis and treatment of prostate cancer. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to the Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We'll take a short break and rejoin Dr. Josh Logan. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our discussion today is revolving around the newest recommendations for prostate cancer and trying to help our listeners understand some of the evidence and reasoning using that evidence that is guiding them. Our guest is Anchorage urologic oncologist, Dr. Josh Logan. Anybody with questions or comments during the next 30 minutes or so can email them to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And always remember, you can listen to this program again. You can come back to it by going to our website and find our archives and listen to the program. It does repeat again tonight between 9 and 10 on this same radio channel, although we cannot take phone calls at that particular time. Also, I want to take one brief second to remind listeners that the point of Line 1 is to inform our listeners about reliable and up-to-date information on a wide range of medical and psychosocial issues. We address subjects like healthcare reform, breast and prostate cancer, food allergies, and even parenting, such as parenting today's teens. So if you're listening right now, you probably are aware that KSKA is important to you, but it's also important to remember that public radio can't continue to provide forums for intelligent voices and thoughts and ideas without the public's financial help. So don't hesitate to call 550-8484 or go online at alaskapublic.org to support KSKA. And a fantastic way to help is consider becoming a sustaining member. Okay, let's take another phone call. Patrick, you're on line one.
Hi, I just have a comment. Want to share my experience with you. In 2010, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, had a biopsy. Gleason scores were about 5 or 6. And I elected to do active surveillance. What I did then, after finding that, I decided to do something about it more actively. I found out that there's certain foods that you eat that starve cancer. A guy by the name of William Lee talks about anti-angiogenesis, so I began to do that. I did lots of exercise, got on the treadmill, did a lot of imaging, and went back and had another biopsy a year later. And the cancer was smaller. It had reduced some. I also noticed that my PSA test went down. So I've continued to do this regimen, and my last PSA test was 5.9, and then I had another one. It was 6.5. I'm 75 years of age, and so I have been relatively symptom-free, not having any kind of symptoms whatsoever. Some of my friends went the route of medication and surgery, and they're suffering as a result of that. So I feel pretty blessed, and I just wanted to share that here's another alternative for people in terms of, rather than waiting and hoping it won't grow, that you can do something really actively by changing your diet, exercising more, and just thinking positively.
No, I think that is the kind of the poster for active surveillance. I mean, you're the guy who clearly didn't need treatment. And again, if I had a takeaway message today, it'd be dissociate screening and diagnosis from treatment, because there are large percentage of patients like yourself who have an indolent cancer. It's cancer. Microscopically, it is cancer. And the reason I say that is there's some discussion about, well, why don't we just quit calling these things cancer? And the pathologists kind of always say back to us, well, I mean, it's cancer. I have to call it what it is. So, but you're clearly that guy that didn't need treatment. But I like that you emphasize active surveillance and that there's an active role for the patient to take this as a teachable moment to take a step back from kind of normal everyday life and say, gosh, you know, am I eating right? Am I getting appropriate exercise? You know, what other health-related changes can I make? Because this is kind of a wake-up call whenever I have a man in the office who gets a diagnosis. I mean, they're you know, they're shaken up, and so it's a teachable moment. And it sounds like you really kind of did all the right things, and you'd be a great resource for a lot of people.
Right. I think if you can actively encourage your patients to take an active part, rather than sitting around and worrying.
Yes.
Sit around and worrying. They're the ones that'll get the radiation. Mm-hmm. They'll get the surgery. But if you feel you can do something about it and you see some success, it really keeps you going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate here just a second, Patrick. If most prostate cancers never kill you, how do you know what yours would have done if you didn't do anything other than, you know, if you had ate popcorn every day or, you know, didn't exercise?
Yeah, I have no idea.
That's my point, and we want to be very careful about evidence. And the way we answer that question is with no individual can we do it. But if we had 100 people that did what you did and 100 people that didn't, and your outcome was and your group was a heck of a lot better than the other group, then we got something here. So
yeah.
I don't want to give the wrong message to somebody who really needs and may need to be more aggressive about at least active surveillance in a much more aggressive way and not close off the possibility. Nobody wants to do treatment. That's the whole argument we got going here between physicians. Nobody wants to do anything we don't have to do, but there are times we got to do some stuff. So,
right. And I'd recommend you do that study.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I didn't ask is I didn't ask Josh if he's aware of nutritional studies that have shown to be as effective. And he's shaking his head. So we don't have that evidence. And I don't know of it either. And there are lots of people who write things like that. But when you really push them, where's the beef, as they used to say on Wendy's? And we don't have it. So you got to be very careful about being sure we got some evidence-based stuff about
your decision. Doctors don't do that, but there are nutritionists that show things like turmeric and things like cooked tomatoes and salmon and strawberries and artichokes really do have an impact in starving cancer cells.
I guess the
need doctors to do more of that research as well.
Doctors have no. I don't know. I don't want to get into that, but I think you want to keep an open mind about and look at that evidence.
Yeah, I think kind of eating for health is very important. I'm unaware of any kind of level one evidence, the kind that Dr. Woodard is describing that clearly shows a benefit, whether in any particular discipline. There's a lot written out there about this type of stuff, but kind of what the highest level of accepted data for kind of proof of cause and effect to date does not exist.
Check out Alzheimer's research in terms of foods and its impact on reducing those plaques. There's a whole new area that's beginning to develop in terms of superfood smoothies and other kinds of nutritional things that don't have the side effects that the medications do.
Sure. I'm an advocate for everything you're describing. I think it just kind of promotes overall health. And if it...
information from Medscape.com, which I think is a pretty reputable site.
Yeah, Medscape. Medscape.
You might check it out. Medscape.com.
Yeah, great.
You know, we're familiar with Medscape.com, but I think we all need to keep an open mind about something that's as dangerous as this to make sure that the evidence is very, very good, and there's nothing that keeps physicians from looking at the nutritional literature.
Yeah, so your PSA and your Gleason score, at your particular age, that was absolutely the right thing to do. I guess what Thad is alluding to is I would be concerned about a guy who's got a Gleason 3-4 or higher 4-3, 4-4, something more aggressive and kind of saying that, I'm going to take a wait and see approach. For the higher that Gleason score goes, the more concerning it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Before I forget, I want to talk about these individuals who may have a rising PSA and a negative biopsy, what that may indicate, and what we don't want to do is miss a particularly aggressive cancer in that situation. And is that situation addressed well in most of the guidelines we have right now, in your mind?
No, the AUA, I'm not sure that they address it in their recommendations or the American Cancer Society, but it is in terms of exciting things on the horizon for prostate cancer management would be prostate MRI. It seems to have a lot of promise, particularly in that clinical scenario where you've got rising PSA, previously negative biopsy, and you're kind of stuck with, well, what do we do from here? The earlier caller asked about PCA3, and that's certainly a test that can be implemented in that scenario that will either raise or lower the index of suspicion for needing to go on to an additional biopsy. But the problem with that is that you can either do an additional, what we call a template biopsy, or you can go on and kind of step it up a level and do what we call the saturation biopsy, where you're taking pretty much double the amount of tissue. But the problem remains is that you're kind of not targeting anything but the prostate itself. So, you know, steps on the scene MRI, and they have the ability to describe and characterize suspicious lesions that can then be specifically targeted. Mm-hmm. And so you've upped the ante a little bit, and this shows a lot of promise. The studies that have come out so far have showed increase in the diagnosis of prostate cancer, increase in the amounts of detection of high-grade prostate cancer. And so there's a lot of promise with this. I had the good fortune of working with some people that arguably have just as much experience with this as anybody in the world. And what was interesting to me is that 7 years into their experience, they still had days where they just had complete misses. Mm-hmm. And so it, again, has a lot of promise, but it is not a perfect test. And then the other issue associated with it is that it increases the diagnosis of cancers overall. And so you're going to see an increase in the amount of indolent cancer detected. And the problem I often find is talking with patients who have an indolent cancer, and they kind of can't get past that word. And yep. So they're off to the races and they want treatment. And despite our best efforts to educate, to counsel them that this isn't something you need to do, they'll seek treatment anyway. So that's a potential shortcoming I see with prostate MRI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's it raises a dilemma again, is we still, it seems to me, need to be able to identify which cancers are really going to cause you significant morbidity. That means pain, suffering, disability, or kill you. And that may be true. That's true, I think, even of breast cancer. I'm not as informed on breast cancer, but we have these increasing abilities to make the diagnosis, but we're still having it seems to me one of the holes in what we need technologically is a way to really predict more accurately the natural history of that tumor, mm-hmm. what's going to happen. Is that
well, I think
right?
With the higher grade tumors, and so far the general consensus is that we call clinically significant prostate cancer really kind of Gleason 7 and above.
Okay. Right.
So, but I'm kind of uncomfortable with just dismissing all Gleason 3 plus 3 or Gleason 6 disease as clinically insignificant. I don't think that's a fair assessment, because I don't think anybody's proven that Gleason 6 doesn't become 7, doesn't become 8, doesn't become 9. And right. So there are now some molecular tests on the market that that I find useful for a guy that is considering active surveillance who has Gleason 6, and these tests can further risk stratify them. And I think that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a phone call. Roger, you're on line one.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
You
I
bet.
Enjoy your program. I had a lump on my upper left quadrant of my prostate for many years. And in 2006, I had a biopsy, and it came out nothing.
Mm-hmm.
My PSA was about 3. And
how old are you?
Right now I'm 75.
Okay.
And in 2011, I had another biopsy, and it was cancer had got to three quarters of my prostate, and started to get into some of the other parts and pieces down there. And rather than have surgery, I elected to have the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Because of issues. I didn't trust my doctor, for one thing. He thought he was Zorro. And so I had 46 radiation treatments, and that's been, I'm almost 2 years now after that, and my PSA is 0.137.
Excellent.
And have you ever cut down a cottonwood tree?
No, sir.
And saw what happens to all the roots. You get sprouts up all over the place. That's what I was afraid of, is surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay.
You cut it and it starts spreading, so I just decided to zap it good. And I had it done at the Cancer Center here at Providence, and I can't speak highly enough of them.
Excellent. It sounds like you had a great experience and nipped it in the bud.
I did, and because I didn't want it to start getting out where it shouldn't be, you know.
Of course.
But I talked to you last week about your tobacco stuff, and that's so I listen all the time.
Okay.
You have a wonderful day, and I appreciate your program. I think you help more than just me. You help everybody that listens.
Roger, thanks very much. You have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So let's go over some general recommendations again for people. I'm not sure in my mind that it's as clear as I was hoping we would get it. And this is a complex issue. I think that's part of it. But I want people to understand there's a risk of doing things. There's a risk of not doing things. And mm-hmm. Everybody got to listen to that. There's a risk of doing it. There's a risk of not doing it. So patients always ask us, physicians, what's the risk of doing it? And that's important. But there's a risk of not doing it as well. And that's important. And another thing that if you believe that statement and it's logical, then you got to also ask yourself, if there's no evidence that it works and there's a risk to everything, but no evidence that it works, then why do something that's got potential risk if we don't have any evidence that it works? So, those are guiding principles in logic and reasoning. Now, the problem is we're constantly getting new information and new ways of looking at things, and we can argue about how accurate the studies are, which you've heard some of us do today. But there's nothing going to be guaranteed in life. There's always going to be the possibility of issues, and we've got to think clearly and use the best evidence that we got. So even now on prostate cancer, there's a little bit of disagreement at times, but what are the general recommendations and why are they there?
Well, it seems to be that primary care physicians or primary care providers are the ones on the front lines that are kind of having to make up their minds about how they're going to or not use this test.
Right.
And that's a dilemma and a challenge because they've got so many things they need to address with a given patient that how do you sit down and describe to them in a short encounter kind of the pitfalls of PSA screening? Mm-hmm. If we look in again at the population-based level, 40% decline in mortality over the last 20 years coincides with the implementation of PSA screening. So there is some benefit to it, albeit with some morbidity. And when I say that, what I mean is primarily the side effects related to surgery, the side effects related to radiation. Surgery, certainly incontinence related to that, urinary incontinence, erectile dysfunction. With radiation, you can get some bowel irritation, certainly bladder irritation and erectile dysfunction over time. So that's really kind of the stakes involved aside from your life. But getting back to the primary care physician, do they really have the time to kind of explain all of that? Once you start on this path, are you you're going to be able to apply the brakes at some point. Because if we're going to dissociate screening and diagnosis from treatment, then that means at some point you got to be willing to just kind of put the brakes on. And for some patients, I think that's challenging. So they screen, they get diagnosis, and they can't kind of stop and say, wait a second, is this a cancer that's going to kill me? Right. Statistically speaking, of course, there would be outliers, but if you know, the numbers are in my favor, maybe avoid treatment.
Yeah. And the thing that bothers me is, again, this individuality, a black individual who's 55, who every male in their family have died of prostate cancer before 70, and their PSA is rising. Is that
perfect index patient to discuss? You're either in front of it or behind it. You can either find out about this early and try to get in front of it, rather than kind of having this thing kind of creep up behind you and you wake up one day and find out, you've got metastatic prostate cancer to the bones, and all of a sudden, we're talking about a whole different ball game.
So the other thing that happens, not only individual variation, but the data that's coming in is changing all the time, and the arguments and the interpretation of the data.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. I think the primary care physician is at that beginning of, do you screen or not? And that's an important one. But, knowing what I know, I mean, it seems like if my screens are okay, nothing's there, I feel pretty good. But if I start seeing some problems, it seems to me that the recommendation ought to be that you really need to sit down with somebody who's up to date on the data and can really give you some good specific recommendations based on the individual individual situation and what's changed in the 2 years since the most recent Cochrane review,
Yeah, there was a paper that came out in New England Journal of Medicine in early March that was an update on prostatectomy versus watchful waiting. And they show a clear mortality benefit. And interestingly, in guys that were under 65, there was not only mortality benefit, reduction in a significant reduction in the incidence of metastases, and the number needed to treat, I think, was 4, which is surprisingly very, very low. Again, there's the potential morbidity associated with that, but at each step of diagnosis, treatment, or diagnosis and management, there's always options. And that's what is important, to sit down with somebody and sort through and figure out what fits and what works and what makes the most sense.
Josh, here's another email that just came in. It's interesting. We've got about 7 minutes or so. This is an email that says, I know two men who've been diagnosed with and died from especially aggressive prostate cancers, in parentheses, inoperable, in their mid-60s. So my understanding is that prostate cancer is typically very slow growing. Is there any evidence that the rate of aggressive prostate cancers might be increasing? Is his question.
I haven't seen statistics on that. I've only seen numbers on the population as a whole in the U.S. When I've seen kind of comparisons between aggressiveness, it's between age groups, and like I mentioned earlier, older men tend to have more aggressive disease, and that's kind of why I mentioned earlier, if a man is screening, don't just arbitrarily stop screening at age 70 if he's a otherwise healthy gentleman. It needs to be an informed kind of tailored decision. But anyways, to answer the question, I don't know of anything suggesting advanced disease is more prevalent. I think that with the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommendation coming out in 2012, there's been a clear decline in the incidence of prostate cancer. As I mentioned, that recommendation came out in 2012. American Cancer Society published 244,000 cases in 2012, and we're down to about, 233,000 for 2014. So my inclination is that they will just present later with more advanced disease. And so I think that that if we're going to see more advanced disease, it will be an artifact of the changes we made in screening.
Is there, in breast cancer, and incidentally, I've been meaning to say this, and it's not ever good to make analogies like this, but there's a lot of similarities between the arguments now about breast cancers and prostate cancers and mammograms and so forth of what we've been talking about, but it's not exactly the same. There's definitely different kinds of breast cancers, and they originate from different cells, and they act differently. They are different people. They're not just cancers. Is there any evidence that we can see that the cancers in individuals that are typically very aggressive early are different cancers, or that there is a difference in perhaps these individuals' immune surveillance or ability to control cancers themselves? Are you aware of anything like that?
So your question is,
is there anything different about these cancers that are real aggressive early, since most aggressive cancers are late? Is it the host, or is it the cancer?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. There's certainly different types of prostate cancer. Any variant, so the garden variety that all the data is published on is what we call adenocarcinoma, mm-hmm. And that's the lion's share of prostate cancer. There are the outlying variants such as basal cell or small cell, which is a neuroendocrine tumor. But I don't know that I don't think I know the answer to that question.
Okay. All right. And one of the things I wanted, we've got about 3 minutes left, is that. That about this MRI, which caught my attention, is there sometimes these tumors might not even be where you think they are. And so mm-hmm. like a mammography, we can do we can see where those ultrasound, we can guide the needle right into where we are. With the prostate, sometimes it might be way up on the front of the prostate, very hard to get at, very hard to feel, very hard to see on a biopsy. Mm-hmm. So that there are situations where the rising PSA is an important indication that might need to be aware of, that MRIs will help for that reason.
MRI holds tremendous promise, not only because of identification of what we call anterior lesions, which is right. what you're talking about, that are difficult oftentimes to get with a traditional biopsy, but I think the other promise that it holds is the ability to potentially identify aggressive cancers. And so that's the great promise for MRI, is that we would be able to really go after lesions that are most suspicious, most worrisome for a prostate cancer that would be of threat to the man's life.
Quick question before I want you to sum up. Just got an email. I had prostate cancer at 53. The writer, should my sons be screened at ages 35 and 33?
So the general recommendation is if you have or the AUA's recommendation is if you have a positive family history, you can start in the 40s. Get a baseline PSA at 40 if it's, where you would expect it to be. Maybe check it again at 45.
Okay. Sum up for us. What do we want people to hear from this complex discussion today?
So I don't think it's time to abandon PSA screening for prostate cancer. I think that we should do it in a risk-adjusted fashion. And I think most importantly that just a short time ago, probably less than 10 years ago, there was just this. If you had prostate cancer, you were treated. It was just kind of reflexive, and I think the new data coming out and certainly the dialogue has led us to say that, wait a minute, let's take a step back and let's figure out who needs to be treated and who doesn't, because clearly not everybody does. And so dissociating screening and diagnosis from treatment, I think, is the thing to do these days.
Listen, thanks very much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
My guest today is Dr. Josh Logan of the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
Hopefully we got some of the complexities over to everybody today. And if you want to continue this conversation on screening for prostate cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. On our next program, we're going to be talking about one of the leading causes of school underachievement, that's attention deficit disorder, with an expert who addresses this every day, Dr. Lynn Clark of Anchorage. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, April 14th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.